I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Bush called on Congress to lift a 27-year-old ban on offshore drilling. In a moment, we'll hear the debate that's ensued around that political claim. Oh, actually, we have it right now. Let's listen to President Bush as he made that call on Congress this morning.
Short run, the American economy will continue to rely largely on oil. And that means we need to increase supply, especially here at home.
The issue dominated the presidential campaign this week. John McCain, who previously opposed offshore drilling, called for it on Monday, joined by Florida Governor Charlie Crist, who once also had been one of the most outspoken opponents of drilling off his state's shores. An estimated 10 years' worth of oil lies under protected waters, and there's growing public support to drill for it, but environmentalists say the amount that could be gained isn't worth the risks of offshore spills. Well, joining us on the line from Washington, reporter Stephen Power, who covers energy issues for the Wall Street Journal. And Stephen, first of all, the president wants Congress to lift its ban on drilling. But he says he won't lift a parallel ban that his father signed in 1990 until Congress goes first. What's going on there?
Well, the president's advisors are saying that he wants Congress to go first. Take you back a little bit on the history here. The current congressional ban has been in place since 1982. When President Bush's father was president, he put in his own ban that directs the Department of Interior not to use any money for any sort of leasing activities or exploratory work in the same areas that are covered by the congressional ban. This was seen by some at the time as an effort to curry support politically in the state of Florida, which was very much in play politically in the presidential contests of 1988 and 1992. And it also was a policy that benefited another Bush, Jeb Bush, who was the governor of Florida until recently and had long been an opponent of drilling off his state's shores.
But now we have voters in Florida and everywhere angry about high gas prices. What is Barack Obama, another candidate, you know, saying in response to candidate McCain's, as somebody said, his one-day embrace of offshore drilling? I mean, this is very, very new for him.
Yeah, well, this is a case where Senator Obama is very much in step with the leadership of his party. He immediately blasted Senator McCain, accused him of flip-flopping on the issue, pointing out that in the past, Senator McCain had supported the moratorium. He has accused Senator McCain of taking the politically expedient way out. Many Democratic Party leaders they argue that it doesn't make sense for the United States to continue to tap oil when the country is trying to get off of oil, off of its oil addiction, and they're increasingly saying that the oil industry needs to make better use of the acreage that it already has. It has access to about 90 million acres on land and offshore, and only about a quarter of that acreage is actually producing oil for reasons that are somewhat in dispute, that range from economic factors, technical reasons, and some Democrats accuse the industry of simply sitting on some of their existing leases, sort of speculating. So there's But right now, Senator Obama is very much attacking Senator McCain over this issue.
Well, Congress was expected to take up extending the ban on offshore drilling today. They've put it off because of all the flooding in the Midwest and other issues. But in the minute or so we have, what do you expect to happen?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to watch. I think the thing to watch right now is what the Democratic Party leadership says, because if you look at it, there seems to be less solidarity on the Democratic side on this issue than on the Republican side. I mean, on the Democratic Party, you do have certain political leaders, rising stars in the party, who are saying that they would like to, at the very least, explore what's out there. You've got Tim Kaine, a moderate Democrat. He's the governor of Virginia. His state is very much in play politically. He has said that he would like to see exploratory drilling off of Virginia's coast just to see what's out there in case the state could benefit from royalties. Mark Warner, the Democratic Senate candidate from Virginia, who's running this year to fill the seat that's being made vacant by John Warner, he's said today that he's in favor of exploratory drilling for both oil and natural gas on the Atlantic and Pacific coasts.
Because these could benefit their states. So obviously this is going to be a many-pronged debate. And, Stephen, we're going to watch it as it continues. So thank you. Stephen Power, staff reporter who covers energy issues for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for catching us up.
Thanks.
Well, a new report is resurrecting an old debate about transracial adoptions. The report found that a much-amended 1994 federal law, the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, or MEPA, is not helping minority children the way it was intended. The law, in its amended form, says that the child welfare agencies cannot consider race in adoption placements. In other words, they can allow white parents to know that a prospective child is black, but other than that, they can't raise the issue of race. Well, the goal was to make it easier to adopt African-American children who disproportionately stay in foster care. But the new report shows that minority children still wait longer than whites to be adopted, and that the colorblind approach leaves many white parents poorly equipped to tackle the cultural challenges their children face. In a few minutes, an African-American adoptee who agrees with the findings. But first, Adam Pertman. He's executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute and editor of the report, Finding Families for African-American Children, The Role of Race and Law in Adoption from Foster Care. Adam, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
A little bit of disclosure. You are an adoptive parent?
I am. My two children are both white kids, so I don't experience transracial adoption.
Well, what is the recommendation of the report, given that the report claims that this colorblind approach isn't working the way it was supposed to?
There are two laws really involved. One is this MEPA that you cited, and then there's a set of amendments. MEPA, which allowed color to be a consideration, the amendments then said you can't take race into account at all. You have to be colorblind. So we suggest that we do not live in a colorblind society yet. And so let's go back to the initial MEPA standard of allowing race to be a consideration. And second, MEPA also dictates that there be diligent recruitment of adoptive and foster parents from the communities these kids come from. And that part of MEPA has not been well enforced. So our other recommendation is go out there and find more parents. If we do, more kids will get homes.
Well, let's take one at a time. What do you mean when you say you want race to be a consideration?
There are two other federal laws that involve the adoption of children transracially. One governs the adoption of Native American children, and the other is the Hague Convention, which governs Americans adopting from other countries. Both laws mandate that race, culture, etc., be taken into consideration, and so we dictate it for some children, and we prohibit it for other kids.
Well, let me jump in. Some might say a child coming from China is coming from a completely different culture. Presumably, in America, these black and white children are Americans.
Well, they're certainly Americans, but I'm not sure we think that white culture in America is identical to black culture in America. I'm sure that white people don't typically face racist taunts on school buses when they're 6 years old.
As you know, because you know that this is somewhat controversial, there are white parents who have raised African-American children who are saying, I did it just as well. But a little disclosure of my own, within my family, there are African-American adopted children. And there are sometimes questions. It would have been nice if a booklet came to discuss hair care because it is different. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it's part of what we're talking about. So, for example, if there were 10 parents in a room adopting kids from foster care, five are black parents, five are white parents. The black parents are adopting black kids. The white parents are adopting white kids, except for two of them. Two of the white parents are adopting African-American children. The federal law prohibits that pamphlet from going to those two white parents who are adopting black kids unless it also goes to all eight other parents. What we're saying is transracial adoption is successful. It is purely and absolutely not a research paper that says there shouldn't be transracial adoption. But these kids consistently say that they face challenges that their parents have not been able to help them confront.
One of the other considerations in the report is whether or not families, white families, should consider moving if they're adopting an African-American child to provide a more diverse environment for them. But right now, that suggestion wouldn't be allowed to be brought up in a council.
Well, unless it were brought up with everybody. So, for example, and this is a real example, there's a couple who wants to adopt a black child. They're white. They have two white kids. And during the home study, just the normal process, they say they don't really like their kids playing with African-American kids.
That really happened? Parents, in the process of adopting a black child, said they didn't like their white kids playing with
Sure.
And they're thinking of adopting an African-American child, which means first of all, what do they think of their two white children playing with their newly adopted black child, but that that black child, in all likelihood, would not be playing with African-American children.
That seems the question. So,
but you can't even raise it under the current law.
You can't, because that's not being colorblind. And what we're saying is that if there are red flags, they at least need to be taken into account. Maybe with a little counseling and some information, that family says, oh, I get it. This kid does need to have a community around him that makes him feel comfortable in his own skin. So it's not necessarily a showstopper, but not doing anything is not necessarily in the best interest of that kid.
Okay, let's take the second aspect of your findings, which is that MEPA charges adoption agencies with seeking out more African-American parents, more parents for the children that need homes.
Right.
You say they're not doing that. How can they do that?
There are efforts that work that are targeted, but that are not colorblind. Some of them are simple advertisements in African-American publications, billboards, but those efforts are prohibited under MEPA in the way that it's currently interpreted.
How do you prevent a slippery slope? If someone's out there worrying, gee, it'll start with counseling, and then it slips back into
the consideration.
Whites can't adopt mixed-race kids. The consideration.
It's a fair question, and I think it's certainly the discussion that we have had internally. So we do think that they have to be very careful in ensuring that the law is written in a way that there be sanctions against people who abuse it. There should be training of the workers to ensure that it's not abused. And the second thing has to do with the world we live in. A dozen years ago, this law was passed in reaction to cases where social workers would not place black kids in white families. We've come away since then. I simply don't think we live in the same place.
You've made a broad statement, but just to make sure we've pointed out, in 2003 and 2005, there were cases of social workers accused of not giving African-American children to
right.
white parents.
And they were sanctioned.
A quick question for you. Is there something profoundly different if someone adopts a child from China? There's a presumption that that child is going to be somewhat different from a child who lives in China currently. When there's an adoption of an African-American child, they're in the same country, and yet the differences can be very extreme when a black child is raised in a white family and when she or he is raised in a black family in certain communities.
All the report is saying is that if you have an African-American child who has experiences that are different from yours, don't you want to know what those might be in case you can parent better, in case you can answer a question about what do I do when the store detective follows me? Mm-hmm. You as a white parent probably didn't experience that a whole lot. So to give some measure of heads up and materials and potential resources seems to me an intuitively sound idea for the sake of the child, not because I want us to live in a country that is colorblind and mm-hmm. I want my child to have a life free of race and racism. That's good. Work for that. But your kid might be followed in the store and you should be able to answer the question of why.
That's Adam Pertman. He's executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. It's an advocacy and research organization that recently published a report urging less colorblindness in transracial adoptions. Adam, thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
And again, of course, there are transracial adoptees with none of these issues, but next, one with many of them. Also later today, did one man move a few sandbags and cause a flood, or was he sandbagged? We'll be back in 1 minute, here and now. Shannon Gibney is a writer living in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Her birth father was African-American, her birth mother white. She was adopted at 5 months old by a white family, so she is biracial in a transracial adoption, and says this new report really validates a lot of her feelings about her adoption. She joins us now from Minneapolis. And Shannon, just tell us first about the role that your adoption, you know, as you knew it, played in your childhood.
My parents, I mean, we've come like a really long way together, but it was not easy by any stretch of the imagination. And in my 20s, it was really difficult. My father said at one point, well, you know, your adoption was an event. It happened and then it was over. And I remember feeling like just a sense of rage when he said that. And
because it wasn't over for you?
I think one of the things that comes up when we talk about transracial adoption is that it's actually a microcosm for the relationship between people of color and white people in the society at large. So a lot of times, white people, in my experience, have said to me, oh, well, you know, you're a person of color, that's your problem. And I think that's the sort of narrative that's going on about race in this country, that most white people don't see themselves as having a race, as white. It's just sort of normalized. And that certainly was the narrative in my family, that, oh, well, Shannon is the racialized one, and so she's the one that has to deal with that racial stuff.
I mean, you had that exchange with your dad. Was that because you were trying to tell him that you were feeling racial issues?
I mean, at that point, a lot of stuff was coming up between myself and my parents. And I remember this was a very painful moment for me growing up, where I had gotten into a huge verbal altercation with my parents. And my father said to my mother right in front of me, "We're not responsible for her racial problems," as if I wasn't there. And that was incredibly painful to me, but it was also a big turning point for me, because I realized, even though I love them and they love me, these people are not going to be able to give me what I need to become the person that I know in my heart I need to be. And so I'm going to have to make the journey that they can't necessarily make with me.
Well, let's back up even further. When you were growing up, did you feel different? Did you feel...
Oh, yeah, of course. I want to reiterate that this is not about love. I mean, my parents, awesome parents in every way possible, but the fact still remained that I was the only person of color in my family. So, of course, any time that we went out to the grocery store or I was playing with my brothers, people would say, I remember one time I was in fourth grade, somebody asked my mom if I was an African exchange student or something. And I mean, just people, when they don't know the story, it really bothers us.
Well, and how would you have liked your parents to be prepared?
What My argument with them was, the moment at which you adopted a black child, the whole family became an interracial family. It was never on me to deal with race. No child can do that.
Well, you've told us of one example of something that happened in your home. Your mom would read children's books to you that had black characters, but your brothers didn't read them.
Right. I knew that I was the black one in the family because I was getting the black things.
This is fascinating. So you're saying that as soon as you were adopted, it's not that a family should expect that the racial child becomes white. You are saying the family should realize they need to become a little black.
Exactly. You know, your child is black or Guatemalan American, and an important part of their identity development is going to be taking part in a black community and, you know, having black friends. My mom used to ask me, and I would get resentful in like third grade, well, why don't you play with this girl, you know, I think her name was Teresa or something.
And this was a black child, and if your mother knew someone she thought was a nice child who was black, she wanted you to be friends.
Exactly. You know, there's sort of two categories. There's parents who are completely unaware of the children's cultural background, and I was sort of like the second level, where my parents understood this is something that Shannon will need in order to feel whole. You know, at certain levels, they were modeling it, right? Because they did have black literature, and they did have, like, a few friends. But to me, they were always window dressing, right? Mm-hmm. And I think kids understand that.
When you got into your 20s, you know, before this, you thought you were the only one, but then you started to meet other transracial adoptees, and you started seeing that they had some of the same issues. They might be Asian, but what would be the equivalent for someone who is an Asian adoptee?
Yeah, it's a profoundly alienating experience being a transracial adoptee. A lot of people in our families don't understand the experience of not having anybody in your family who looks like you. And then at the same time, when we actually interact with people who do look like us, we maybe don't have the cultural references. My Korean-American friends, they don't speak Korean. Mm-hmm. So there's all these different things where you feel like you're inauthentic in both groups.
It sounds like it can get very complicated because, let's say your parents had recognized that you were feeling this alienation and maybe decided, oh, let's go to a black church. Then it sounds as if you would be feeling as if, once again, they were doing something that drew attention to your difference.
It is very complicated. And I think that's why if you're going to adopt, you need to hear all these different perspectives, especially the perspectives of adult adoptees and birth mothers or birth fathers about some of their experiences.
Well, now we are hearing from people like you, and that's probably because this is a relatively new phenomenon.
Yes.
You really are the front line on this, the first generation that's growing up.
Yes.
I just want to ask, I know you have a great relationship with your parents now after really struggling with a lot of this. But one of your brothers, you know, I don't want you to go into details, but you know, you have sort of a schism with one of your brothers.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
this can be very painful.
I mean, I know for my parents especially, it's been, I mean, I haven't talked to my older brother in 6 years, and we live probably 15 minutes drive from each other. And
Well, I hope that heals. But that can be part of the problem of transracial adoptions when members of your adoptive family can't or won't relate to your interest in racial issues. And as you think of, you know, having a family of your own, who are your friends? Who do you seek out? You know, what community are you living
in?
Well,
I'm very, very happy with my community right now. I live in Minnesota. There's a ton of Korean adoptees here. So a lot of my friends are Korean adoptees.
So you've chosen communities of trans race. And this is, it sounds like another reason why families need to be comfortable with that, because their children are going to choose these other communities when they grow up.
Yeah, exactly. And I think my parents saw that that was happening in my late 20s and really made a shift in their relationship with me, and that's made everything afterwards possible.
That's Shannon Gibney. She's a writer living in Minneapolis, Minnesota, speaking about being a transracial adoptee. Shannon, thank you so much. Just fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, still to come today, Hip Hop in the Classroom, after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Volunteers continue to fill hundreds of thousands of sandbags along the Mississippi River after floodwaters breached two levees in western Illinois today and threatened more towns further south in Missouri. So far, the flooding that began in eastern Iowa has caused more than $1.5 billion in damages, and as we've seen, tens of thousands have been forced from their homes. In Quincy, Illinois, one of two bridges has been shut down and a major road is underwater. Residents there are making comparisons to the Great Midwestern Flood of 1993. It hit more than 500 counties with damages totaling $12 billion.
It's scary. It's scary because I look a lot of 93 compared to right now, and we're not far off. We're not far off at all.
Quincy, Illinois is just across the river from West Quincy, Missouri, where the levee failed to hold back floodwaters in 1993. And of the hundreds of volunteers back then, one man was held responsible for that breach. James Scott was convicted of sabotaging the levees by tampering with sandbags. He remains the only person in Missouri history to be convicted of intentionally causing a catastrophe. Then 24, he was sentenced to life in prison. Had he been convicted on the other side of the river in his home state of Illinois, the maximum sentence would have been 7 years. And some wonder if he should have been convicted at all. Adam Pitluck is one of those. He chronicled Scott's story in Damned to Eternity, the story of the man they said caused the flood. And Adam joins us now. And Adam, James Scott himself, in fact, in a local television interview before he was charged, said he had moved a few sandbags on the levee when he saw a leak.
That's right. James Scott did indeed move some sandbags on the levee. However, James Scott was not unique. James Scott was one of thousands of volunteers over the period of a month who were doing just that, filling sandbags, walking them up this earthen dike, placing them atop it to weight down a plastic tarp that would keep the Mississippi River from eroding the sand levee. And then he and other volunteers, when they saw what were deemed to be potential trouble spots, they'd pick up more sandbags and they'd move them around. So he did nothing out of the ordinary. In fact, he did exactly what the Missouri and Illinois National Guardsmen told him to do.
Well, a detective saw him on that local TV broadcast and became suspicious because he knew him from James Scott's past run-ins with the law. He'd been convicted of arson twice. He burned down his own elementary school when he was 12. He was a severe alcoholic. And witnesses provided compelling evidence against him. They said, among other things, that he had said he wanted to cause a levee breach so that he could strand his wife on the other side of the river and he could go out and party.
Exactly. This is the guy who wanted to break a levee so he could party without his wife. Back in 1993, this was, in media parlance, a sexy story. All the networks ran with it. NPR ran with it. The AP moved the story onto its wire. And you touched at the heart of this matter here. James Scott was not a nice guy. In fact, he was a scourge on society in this small hamlet of America. The problem, though, that I have with this case, and that what many other outsiders who aren't from this area have with the case, is the fact that there's zero evidence. There's no physical evidence. The circumstantial evidence is not only weak, but it's changed over time. And the only story that's maintained its consistency over the last 15 years is James Scott's story. So that's where I come in.
Well, and two soil science experts were called at the trial on behalf of James Scott. One said that six scenarios could cause a levee system to fail, And the day the levee breached, all six conditions were in place. Did both pretty much say they didn't feel one person could cause such a huge breach?
Both Dr. R. David Hammer and Dr. Charles Morris, two of the most respected soil and atmospheric scientists in the state of Missouri, let alone in scientific circles, both testified that this levee failed because of natural causes. They also went so far as to say that any one man who would have been digging in the dirt trying to break a levee when the river was at the stage that it was would have died in doing so. The water was too high, the pressure butting up against the levee was too great, and the current would have been too strong. So the reason he was convicted, though, is gets back to that point, you know, here's a chance to put away a local bad boy for good. I mean, he never was convicted of any violent crimes. It was property damage, and he caused a lot of heartache and a lot of angst among the community. At the same time, though, in this particular community, the farmers could have bought federal flood insurance. Many of them didn't. So if the levee were to be an act of God, they wouldn't be covered. If it were to be an act of sabotage, they could collect and be made whole again through their homeowner's policy.
Are you saying that you think that a man was sent to jail for life because the people on the jury and the people in the town knew that if somebody was charged with sabotaging the levee, they would get insurance payouts, whereas if it was what many specialists said it was, just an act of nature, they wouldn't? Are you saying that's why they sent a man to jail for life?
I'm saying exactly that, with the exception of the jury. The jury was not in cahoots. The jury had no way of knowing that this was going on, and they couldn't have known it because the prosecution just outclassed his court-appointed defense attorney.
So the defense attorney never brought it up?
Defense attorney never brought it up. Here's what else is going on right now, and it's almost ironic that we're having this conversation less than 2 weeks, marking the 15th anniversary of the breaching of the West Quincy levee. More than 500 levees broke up and down the Mississippi, and more than 1,000 in the Midwest when you factor in the other rivers, the Iowa, the Raccoon, the Des Moines, the Missouri. So we have thousands of levee breaks, and yet one man is serving a life sentence for causing one levee break in a community where nobody died, let alone nobody was even injured. As we speak, West Quincy is battling the exact same volume in the Mississippi River, and the height of the river is back at 32 feet. That's what it was when it flooded in 93. It could break any day. Some experts are predicting it's going to break on Friday. Some are saying even earlier than that. How much egg is going to be on the face of the officials in West Quincy, Missouri, and across the river in Quincy, Illinois, if their levee, which would have held were it not for James Scott, breaches 15 years later? There's no mea culpa bigger than that, and that would be evidence that there's an innocent man in prison.
Well, James Scott was tried and convicted not just once, but twice. He got a second trial because of misconduct by the prosecutor in the first trial, but he was still convicted. Does he have any avenues left?
James Scott has several avenues left. One is to put this case to appeal it in federal court. Second would be a gubernatorial pardon, and third would be the long shot of long shots, which would be a presidential pardon. Now, because of this book, though, there's a law firm in New York City that is quite put out by this case, and they are in the process right now of picking it up.
Well, Adam Pitluck, again, author of Damned to Eternity, the story of the man who they said caused the flood, the book you've been speaking of. Meanwhile, you know, you're a writer for Time magazine. You've got, you know, other writing under your belt, and you are staking your career, it would seem, on this case. Why?
I'm staking my reputation on this case because I think it's a miscarriage of justice, and I'm willing to pick up that flag and fight.
Adam Pitluck, again, author of Damned to Eternity. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And here's a quick update on a story we've been following, somewhat related. President Bush today vetoed the $290 billion farm bill for the second time. There was a clerical error in the printing of the first bill the president vetoed, so Congress had to pass it again. And today Bush vetoed it again. Both chambers of Congress have the votes to override the veto. They're expected to do so, and then the bill becomes law. A reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live on our website, here-now.org. For past programs, click on the archives. You can also download a podcast. Take us with you wherever you go, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Think of the things the U.S. has borrowed from India. Chess, henna tattoos, software engineers. Now the U.S. is giving something back. cheerleaders, and it's caused a little bit of a controversy. A group of American football cheerleaders just returned this month from India, where they were pepping up crowds at cricket matches. Heather Tran is a 5-year veteran and line captain of the Washington Redskins cheerleaders. She's just returned. Heather, where were you cheering in India? What team?
We were cheering for the Bangalore Royal Challengers.
And what was that like? I mean, do you know much about cricket before you went?
I absolutely knew nothing about cricket. I tried to catch some games while I was here in the States. I did a little research on the web, but it was a whole new ball game for me. It was kind of a crash course as soon as I got to India and had to learn the ropes when we went to our first game.
Well, I had to learn myself from colleagues Hamid and Hitesh. And from what I understand, players do come to bat, but they hit the ball with what we think of as more of a golf stroke, and then they run between wickets.
That's correct.
So the cheering, now, are you doing, you know, defense, or what kind of cheering are you doing?
We're called cheerleaders, however, we actually dance. So we did the same thing when we went to India. We never yelled defense or anything along those lines. It was always dancing.
But, you know, there's been some controversy. The BBC reporting politicians in India were completely appalled at the idea of American cheerleaders at a cricket game, especially the dress of cheerleaders. So did you change your outfits at all to address this issue?
We came over there in our uniforms, which is a half top and shorts. And the reason we decided to stick with that was because we wanted to bring a piece of our culture over there. Our team had no problem with our uniforms. That's why they had us wear them. That's why they had us on the field. And you have your mixed bag of people, and I think it depends on who you ask on how they felt about it. A lot of the people we spoke with actually enjoyed the fact that we brought something different to the game.
Well, I want to ask you about that because some of the cheerleaders reported that they were jeered or heckled by people in the crowd. How did the crowd treat you?
I've heard comments about the heckling, and I'm not sure whether or not that came from cheerleaders or if that came from reporters saying that people were heckling us. The problem was that there's a language barrier. So if someone was yelling something rude or anything along those lines, I wouldn't have known it anyway.
Right.
But everyone seemed to be happy with us.
We want to point out, too, that many people fully support this idea of American cheerleaders at Indian cricket games. Some Bollywood actors even own some of the teams, and they say it's no worse than belly dancers in a Bollywood film. But what was the game like? I mean, what did you observe?
The games were amazing. We would actually stand on these 6-foot by 6-foot podiums. We would dance on those as music was being played when the game was getting ready to start. And anytime we made a good play, we would jump up on our podium. We would cheer. We would get the fans excited. The fans would dance with us, and they would kind of imitate us and dance along.
They would dance with you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, not directly with us, but they would be in front of us. There's usually like a gate. They would move along with us and try to mimic what we were doing. And the Indian culture is so much more motivated than here at NFL games. They don't get up much. They don't jump around and dance like they do in India.
Well, and did you see anything in Indian moves? I mean, we mentioned the Bollywood films and belly dancing. Anything that you are bringing back?
Our dance culture is so completely different from the Indian culture. It's amazing. We do a lot of jumps and turns, but they're more into eye movements and these intricate hand movements, and the way that they move their hips is a lot different from how we move them. To try to merge the two would almost be an injustice, just because they're just so completely different, and I think they're both kind of beautiful in their own way.
That's Heather Tran, veteran cheerleader for the Washington Redskins, who just spent a month cheering for Indian cricket games. Heather, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate it.
This is what makes those other moments so sweet, to climb all the way to the top. This is a dream come true, and I'm going to cherish this forever.
The Boston Celtics beat the LA Lakers last night by 39 points, clinching the NBA championship title. But I am not gloating because of a heartbroken 14-year-old. My nephew here in Boston never caught the Celtics bug because, to be honest, there wasn't one when he was growing up. The Celtics were terrible. He didn't care about ancient history. When I showed him a picture of me with Larry Bird, it must have been like my parents talking about the days before television. No, he fell in love with Kobe Bryant and the Lakers. When the Celts, who were in last place last year, started winning this season, I said to him, "It's not too late to convert." And I'll never forget his disdain as he said, "Aunt Robin, real fans don't bandwagon." So today, I love my Celts again. But as I take my place on this suddenly very crowded bandwagon, I respect my nephew more. Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
What you got for him? Okay, let me put my gloves on and my scrubs on. Dr. Carter to the rescue. Excuse me if I'm late, but like a thief, it takes time to be this great. So just wait, your style is a disgrace.
Hey, turn off the music. Hit the books. You got a big test tomorrow. That warning is echoing in homes across the country this week as kids take final exams. But what if hip-hop could teach them math equations or the names of the layers of the earth? A new educational rap company is trying to do just that with songs about everything from verb tenses to the 27 Amendments. They've tested the music in classrooms, and the reviews so far have been both positive and amused. Here now's Victoria Chang has more.
On a sunny June day at the Epiphany School in Boston, Vin Camilio's 8th grade students are going over material for their final math exam. Their review has a bit of a spin to it, though.
How do I work your fractions whole? Multiply, it's just like you know. Add, subtract, it seems so hard at first, but on this track, you'll learn by the third verse.
The kids have put their books aside for now to sing an educational rap song called How Do I Work with Fractions? Student Kimberly Rivera uses the word cheesy to describe the tune, but she adds this caveat.
It's kind of hard to explain, but I like the beats. I think it makes it more fun for students to like learn about the math. I'd rather have that than have to learn like hear a lesson like all day long for like an hour and 30 minutes, so I thought it was actually kind of fun.
Teacher Vin Camilio says his initial doubts about combining rap music with mathematical concepts vanished in the face of his students' enthusiastic response.
I've taught 39 years. I really wasn't interested in it. Rap music in the classroom, I figured no. But the kids just fell in love with it. The kids were going around the school humming the tune and remembering the mathematical concepts that go with the tune.
And that's music to the ears of three recent college graduates who founded Rhythm Rhyme Results, or Triple R. They call themselves an educational rap company and hope to capitalize on the way rap music lends itself to memorization. It all started after Triple R co-founder Ben Jackson took a course on songwriting. On a lark, he rapped the lyrics he'd written about the Bill of Rights over a set of beats.
And then, like, a couple of days later, I was kind of caught myself saying the song to myself, and I realized that for the first time in my life, I knew the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and so that was sort of an epiphany.
The right to free speech and religion and press are guaranteed by Amendment 1. Amendment number 2 says it's true that it's all up to you if you choose to possess a gun.
In May, Triple R released 3 demos on iTunes, 10 tracks each on science, social studies, and language arts, with a forthcoming math release rounding out the series. Co-founder Robbie Mitchell admits the idea of educational rap raised eyebrows, especially when trying to sell the program to teachers.
The genre has developed a gangster image, especially for adults. Sometimes there's a visceral reaction. Oh, I hate rap. There's nothing wrong with the music inherently. It's just the lyrics have such specific topics in mainstream hip-hop. The whole goal was to not be condescending to kids, to make it sound like something that you would listen to if you're 18 and listening to the radio.
To make sure kids would listen, Triple R recruited rappers, DJs, and producers with thriving careers on the music scene. Among them, Janosch Fulop, a Boston-based producer who goes by the alias The Archetype. Fulop says he was intrigued by the challenge of turning educational material into good rap. But he says some of the artists he approached were initially skittish about the endeavor. One rapper, who goes by the name of Kazuo, even created a new alias just for his work with Triple R.
The balancing of artistic integrity, making sure that the topic is covered in the way it needs to be covered to meet the educational standards, it's a fine balance. You have to walk that line real well, you know, in order to put your name on it.
One song that Kazuo and Fulop created for the project has been Triple R's biggest draw on iTunes. It's a history rap to help students study the nation's 43 presidents.
memorizing presidents is gonna take some effort. Start with George Washington, Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. Then James Madison and James Monroe. John Quincy Adams like his father before. Next up, we got some interesting folks named Jackson, Van Buren, Harrison, Tyler, and Polk. The next four presidents that we'll examine are Taylor, Fillmore, Pearson, Buchanan.
Don't let Kanye West get a hold of this one. He'll definitely steal that, for sure.
That's Chris Ferrone, a music critic who writes about hip-hop for publications such as The Source and Spin Magazine. He says Triple R has avoided mistakes made in previous attempts at educational music, such as Schoolhouse Rock, by producing music that can hold its own with the best hip-hop on radio today.
I was never able to memorize the presidents. I was an ADD-addled child and adolescent. I think I could definitely do it with this. The beat is hot. I like the way they have Hail to the Chief cut up in there. The DJ's doing his job. It's real hip-hop. 43 presidents, White House residents,
from the revolution of the age of the internet. For some of the artists working with Triple R, writing songs based on a middle school curriculum has taken them back to their student days. Take the rapper MC Kabir. He says he hated science, but took on a commission to write a song about photosynthesis.
I'll tell you, that photosynthesis one was tough. For one thing, it was something that I never thrived in school. There was that sort of natural apprehension that came from that childhood sense of not being good at science. And then there was also the challenge of how to make it accessible to kids.
The Calvin cycle or Dart reaction doesn't need direct sunlight for it to run right. CO2 from the air enters the chloroplast, mixing with organic molecules for the last time with the help of the enzyme Rubisco called the fixation. I thought you knew this, yo. It forms a carbohydrate known as G3P. It's created, recreated, and recycled, you see. Photosynthesis, let's get into this discussion of sunlight and transfer of energy.
Another challenge of writing music with such carefully controlled content is finding tenable rhymes to sustain the lyrics. For a song on the circulatory system, what word rhymes with aorta?
Next up, we'll talk about the arteries. They take blood from the heart to where it's gotta be. The biggest artery, the main transporter. Right next to the heart, it's called the aorta.
Company founder Ben Jackson majored in linguistics in college and approaches rhyming as a puzzle to crack.
For me, I usually start by taking the clunkiest word, like aorta, or like bibliography if we're talking about writing, and see if I can rhyme that with something. And for that, a rhyming dictionary is absolutely essential, and you have to learn how to work with it flexibly. And once I had that, I was like, okay, like this song can be written. If we can rhyme something with aorta, we can certainly write a song about the circulatory system.
You could tell that they really tried and they did a good job.
Epiphany School 7th grader Omar Augustin listens to the Triple R tracks on the company's website. He says the music is as good as what he usually listens to, like 50 Cent and Lupe Fiasco.
I've heard a lot of educational music, and it's not the same. Just like a tune like the ABCs, it's educational, but it's not really well thought out or anything. But this, they added verses, choruses, and it's just like the format of a regular song, but it serves a better purpose.
And when Triple R's Ben Jackson hears comments like that, he just chuckles.
Students, you know, they're savvy and they understand that what we're doing is, for lack of a better word, is unnatural. You know, to take the material of a classroom and repackage it in something that's supposed to be cool and fun. It's inherently cheesy, but as long as they're giving us the benefit of the doubt and as long as they are listening to it and enjoying it for what it is, that's all we can really ask for.
Know the variables, listen to me. M is a slope, that's rise over run. It tells you how steep the line.